still existed. Well, it did last time I was out there. Which was when, exactly? 500 years or so ago? Yes, all right, you needn't get all snippy.
The hulking diplomat spoke in rumbling tones.
Hodge is taking his time.
Can he actually read? I said. That may have been the flaw in our plan.
Of course he can. Hush! She's coming back.
I have the key now, sirs, madam, if you would be so good.
The manager trotted along a dimly lit corridor, all oak panels, gilded mirrors, and unnecessary pots on stands, pointing out assorted arches.
That is the dining room in there, decorated in the Rococo style, with an original painting by Boucher. Beyond are the kitchens. To our left is the grand lounge, the only room where one is permitted to use demons. Elsewhere we forbid their presence, since they are in general unhygienic, noisy, and a repellent nuisance, particularly gin. Did you speak, sir?
Cormac Codrin had uttered a croak of rage. He swallowed it down.
No, no.
Tell me, the manager continued, is Sheba a magical society? I'm afraid I should know, but I have learned so little of other lands. One has so much to do to occupy oneself in one's own country, don't you think? It is hard to have much time for foreigners, particularly when so many of them are savages and anthropophagi. Here is the lift. We ascend to the second floor.
Manager and diplomats entered the lift and turned to face the front. As the doors eased shut, a whirring sound was heard. Unnoticed by the manager, a noisome insect, all spines and strange emissions, slipped through the closing crack, flitted onto the sleeve of the Sheban woman, and crawled up to her ear. It whispered briefly. She turned to me, mouthed the message.
Room 23.
I nodded. We had the information we required. The four Sheban diplomats glanced at each other. As one, they turned their heads slowly to look down at the diminutive manager, who was wittering away complacently about the delights of the hotel sauna, oblivious to the sudden change in atmosphere in the crowded lift. "We don't have to," I said in Arabic. "We could tie her up."
"She might squeak," said the female diplomat. "And where would we put her?"
"True."
"Well, then."
The old lift trundled on. It came to the second floor. The doors opened. Four Sheban diplomats stepped out, accompanied by a whirring insect. The biggest of the four was picking his teeth with a polished whalebone hair grip. He finished presently, stuck the whalebone in the soil of a voluminous pot plant outside the lift, and padded after the others down the silent hall. With the door to room 23 in sight, we halted once again.
"What do we do?"
Mwamba whispered. Escobol made an impatient noise.
"We knock. If he's there, we break down the door and get him. If not..."
His flood of inspiration had wearied him. He ceased.
"We get inside and wait."
That was Hodge, buzzing around our heads. "The woman mentioned a door guard," I cautioned. "We'll have to deal with it."
"How hard can it be?"
The group of diplomats approached the door. Mwamba knocked. We waited, looking up and down the corridor. All was still. Mwamba knocked again. There was a movement within a circular panel in the centre of the door. The wood grains shifted, rippling and contorting to form the faint outline of a face. It blinked sleepily and spoke in a squeaky nasal voice.
"The occupant of this room is out. Please return later."
I stepped back and considered the base of the door. "It's pretty tight-fitting. Think we could slip under there?"
"Doubtful," Mwamba said. "Keyhole might be okay if we change to smoke."
There was a titter from Escobol.
"Bartimaeus won't need to change. Look at his lower half. It's gaseous already."
Hurtful, coarse. But there was a grain of truth in it. I hadn't quite deteriorated as far as my condition with the frog, but with every passing minute my strength and essence control became a little less. I was a little fluid about the trousers. Cormac Codrin was frowning down at his hulking torso.
"I'm not sure I do smoke."
The door guard had listened in with some concern.
"The occupant of the room is out,"
it squeaked again.
"Please do not attempt entrance. I will be forced to act."
Escobol stepped close.
"What manner of spirit are you? An imp?" Yes, sir. Indeed I am.
The door guard seemed unfeasibly proud.
How many planes can you observe? 5? Very well. Take a look at us on the 5th. What do you see? Well, do you not tremble?
The face on the door had swallowed audibly.
A little, sir. But if I may ask, what is that nebulous blot hovering on the right?
That is Bartimaeus. Pay no attention to him. We others are ruthless and strong and demand to enter the room. What do you say? A pause. A heavy sigh.
I am bound by a bond, sir. I must prevent you.
Ascobol cursed.
Then you sign your death warrant. We are powerful djinn. You are a smudge of insignificance. What can you hope to do? I can sound the alarm, sir, which is what I have just done.
A faint popping, as of bubbles bursting in hot mud. The diplomats glanced left and right. Along the corridor on either side, a number of heads were rising from the carpet. Each head was oval, like a rugby ball, smooth and shiny, beetle-black, with 2 pale eyes set closely near the base. Each popped free and rose into the air, trailing a writhing strip of tentacles. "We need to deal with this quickly, quietly and neatly," Wamba said. "Hopkins can't know anything has happened."
"Right."
In a somewhat menacing silence, the heads drifted in our direction. We didn't hang around to see what they planned to do. We acted, each one according to their specialty. Mwamba sprang at the wall, scrambled up it and onto the ceiling, from where she clung like a lizard, discharging spasms at the nearest head. Hodge swelled from insect size in the blink of an eye, turned and shook his skin, hurling innumerable poison darts toward the enemy. From Ascobol's shoulders, feathered wings protruded. He rose into the air and fired a detonation. Cormac Codron became a man-boar. He lowered his tusks, rotated his massive shoulders, and charged into the fray. As for me, I nipped behind the nearest ornamental pot plant, erected what shield I could, and tried to look inconspicuous. I'd have loved to take part in the fight. Loved to. Ordinarily, I'd have been first in line to fight the squiddy-head things. But that wasn't my brief just then. I had precious little essence left to spill. I'd vaguely wondered, as I rearranged the biggest leaves, what sort of threat the floating heads might pose. I soon discovered. As soon as one or two drew close, the heads tipped back, the tentacles drew apart, and tubes within squirted forth black sprays that deluged everything before them. Cormac Codron was caught mid-charge. He let forth a bellow of pain. Where it hit, the liquid burned his essence. It bubbled, spat, ate into his form. Even so, he was not done. He lunged with his tusks and sent a head crashing down the hall. Ascobol's detonation caught another, exploding it in mid-air. Black spray splashed against the walls, further coating the writhing Cormac Codron and even pattering onto the topmost leaves of my trusty pot plant. Up on the ceiling, Mwamba sprang and dodged, avoiding all but the slightest smears of black. Her spasms found their mark. Here and there heads whirled and shook themselves apart. Hodge's poison darts had likewise speared a couple. They swelled, turned yellow, and sank to the carpet, where they became ichorous and faded. The heads put on a surprising turn of speed. They darted this way and that, seeking to evade the darts, spasms, and detonations, and to get around behind the djinn for further attacks. In this they were hampered by the confines of the corridor, and by a madness that seemed to have infected Cormac Codron. With molten tusks and a face that blurred and steamed, he roared and charged, swiping with his fists, grasping tentacles, trampling with his hooves, seemingly insensible to the gouting spray. With such a foe, the heads were up against it. In less than a minute, the last one gloopily subsided. The battle was over. Mwamba dropped down from the ceiling. Ascobol floated to the floor. I stepped nimbly out from behind the plant. We regarded the corridor. It was going to give next morning's cleaners quite a surprise, whatever plane they operated on. Half the walls were coated with the spray. It hissed and foamed and ran in rivulets to the floor. The corridor was a kaleidoscope of stains, scorches, and congealing slime. Even the front half of my pot plant had been badly burned. I rotated it carefully to present its good side to the world. "There," I said brightly. "Think Hopkins is going to notice anything?" Cormac Codron was in poor shape, the boar's head scarcely recognisable, his tusks blackened, his nice tattoos quite gone. With limping steps he approached the door of room 23, where the imp watched, blinking in its circle.
"Now, my friend," he said, "we must decide upon the nature of your death."
"One moment," the door guard cried. "There is no need for such unpleasantness. Our difference of opinion is at an end."
Cormac Codron narrowed his eyes.
"Why so?"
"Because the occupant of the room has now returned, and you can take up the matter with him personally. Good day to you."
The grains of wood shifted and relaxed. The outline of the face was gone. There was a second or two while we stood pondering the mystery of the imp's words. Then a further second as we slowly turned to look back down the hall. Halfway along it stood a man. He had evidently just come in from outside, for he wore a winter coat over a dark grey suit. His head was bare and slightly windswept. A shock of brownish hair fell down across a face that was neither old nor young. It was the same man I'd seen in the park. Slender, pigeon-chested, thoroughly unremarkable. He had a plastic bag of books in his left hand. Even so, something about him tugged uneasily at my memory, just as it had last time. What was it? I'd have sworn I'd not met Hopkins before. I viewed him on the seven planes. Hard to be sure, but his aura seemed a little stronger than most humans. Perhaps it was just the lights. He was certainly a man. Mr. Hopkins looked at us. We looked at him. Then he smiled, turned, and ran. Off we went, M'Wamba and Ascobol in the lead, Hodge pounding after, me next, conserving as much energy as I could, and finally poor old Cormac Codron bringing up the rear. It was his wounds that slowed him mainly, but his recent meal can't have helped. He'd really bolted the manager down. Around the corner we piled, into the alcove with the lift. Where's he gone?
There, stairs, quick.
Up or down? I saw a flash of sleeve on the turn below. Down, quick, change someone. A shimmering. M'Wamba was a bird with black-green wings diving down the centre of the stairwell. Ascobol became a vulture, a less astute choice, since he had trouble turning his bulk in the narrow space. Hodge shrank, climbed onto the balustrade in the form of an evil-looking pangolin. He curled up into a ball so that his plates protected him and dropped bodily down the shaft. No such speed for me or Cormac Codron. We hurried after them as best we could. Down to the ground floor, through swing doors, out into the corridor. I halted, only to be knocked sprawling by Cormac Codron, charging blindly along behind.
Which way did they go?
I don't know. We've lost them. No, listen. Sounds of shouts and screams, always a good indication of where my chums might be. It came from the direction of the dining room. As we watched, a number of humans, a pick-and-mix assortment of customers and kitchen staff, came bursting through the arch and fled howling up the corridor. We waited for the tubbiest to wheeze past, then hurried on. Into the dining room, along a trail of scattered chairs, cutlery and broken glass, and through a set of swing doors into the hotel kitchen. Ascobol looked around.
"Quick," he cried. "We've got him surrounded."
The Cyclops was standing astride a metal sink top, pointing. To his left, M'Wamba blocked the space between two racks of pans, her scaly tail swishing idly to and fro, her long forked tongue flicking at the air. To his right, Hodge had hopped upon a chopping table, and was raising and lowering his poison spines with malevolent intent. All were staring fixedly at the far corner of the kitchen, where the fugitive had taken refuge. Behind him was solid wall, no doors or windows. He had no chance of escape. Cormac Codron and I took our places in the line. Ascobol glanced across at us.
"The fool's refusing to come quietly," he hissed. "We need to scare him a bit. Hodge has done some pretty manic tittering, but he hasn't budged an inch. Come on, Bartimaeus, can't you manage something a little more fearsome? Pep up your guys."
You might argue that a man who wasn't scared of a cyclops, a boar-headed warrior, a giant lizard, and a vicious-looking pangolin with the titters wouldn't be too fussed at one monster more or less, but I took the point. A Sheban diplomat isn't the most terrifying thing in the world. I rummaged through my inventory of guises, and picked out one that used to awe the people of the plains well enough. The diplomat vanished. In his place stood a tall, sinister figure, hung about with a cape of feathers and animal bones. He had a man's body, but his head, sleek and black with eyes of yellow fire, was a savage crow's. The cruel beak opened, loosing a wicked claw upon the world. Assorted cutlery rattled across the kitchen. I bent my head toward Ascobol.
How's that? It'll have to do.
As one, the five terrible djinn stepped closer to their prey.
You may as well put that thing down, Umwamba advised sternly. We've got you trapped.
Ah, yes. That thing. I'd noticed it, too. It was a certain kind of kitchen implement that Mr. Hopkins had picked up in self-defense. But far from holding it fearfully in front of him, as you might expect, he was toying with it in a manner unbefitting a scholar, tossing it up into the air with one hand and catching it nimbly between finger and thumb of the other. If it had been a tin opener or a potato peeler, even a ladle or soup spoon, it wouldn't have bothered me so much. But it wasn't any of those things. It was a meat cleaver, and a large one, too. Something about the way he wielded it rang a few faint bells.
"Well, now," Mr. Hopkins said, smiling, "here's a conundrum. Have you trapped me, or is it the other way around?"
He gave a little kick of his legs as he said this, as if he were about to start dancing some horrible Celtic jig, instead of which he rose gently off the floor and hovered over us, grinning from ear to ear. This was unexpected. Even Hodge stopped his eager snickering. The others glanced at each other in astonishment. Not me, though. I was silent, frozen where I stood, an uncomfortable finger of ice travelling at leisure down my spine. I'd known the voice, you see. It wasn't that of any Mr. Hopkins. It wasn't even human. It was Fakwal's. Chapter 20. Bartimaeus.
Chaps, I ventured, I think we should go carefully here.
From his position in mid-air, Mr. Hopkins tossed the cleaver high. Flashing as it spun, it arced around a ceiling light and landed handle first back upon his outstretched finger. He caught my eye and winked. Ascobol was rattled, but he talked big to cover it.
"So he can levitate," he snarled, "and do juggling tricks. So can half the starving fakirs of India, and I never ran from them. Come on, remember, we've got to take him alive."
With an unearthly cry, he leapt down from his sink-top. The crow-headed man held out a hand of caution.
"Wait," I said. "Something's wrong here." His voice. "You coward, Bartimaeus!"
The pangolin loosed a volley of darts that pattered into the floor beside my feet.
"You fear for what remains of your essence. Well, hop on the nearest chair and squeal. Four proper djinn can handle this man." "But that's just it," I protested. "I'm not sure this is a man. He's..."
"Of course I am."
Up on high, Mr. Hopkins tapped his chest proudly.
"Planes 1-7, flesh and blood, can't you see?"
It was true. He was human whichever way you looked at it. But it was Fakwal who spoke. The giant lizard swung her tail in agitation. It caught against a cooker and sent it crashing on its side.
"Hold on," Mwamba said. "What language are we speaking?"
In the heat of the moment, we djinn sometimes lose track of which lingo we're using. When working together in this world, we tend to speak languages familiar to us all, and not necessarily the one used by the civilization du jour. There you go, you see.
Aramaic, why?
Because he can speak it too.
So what? He's a scholar, ain't he?
In times of stress, Ascobol could pulverize Semitic tongues.
Yes, but it seemed a little odd.
Mr. Hopkins inspected his watch ostentatiously.
"Look, I'm sorry to butt in," he called, "but I'm a busy man. I have some important business this evening which concerns us all. If you lot clear off now, I'll spare you. Even Bartimaeus."
Cormac Cauldron had been resting his poorly essence against an 8-hob oven, but at these words he erupted into life.
"You'll spare us," he roared. For that piece of impudence I shall gore you, and not gently.
He pawed the ground with a hoof and started forward. The other djinn followed his example. There was a general rattling of horns, spines, scales, and other armoured bits. Mr. Hopkins chucked the cleaver casually to his right hand and spun it around his fingers.
"Wait, you idiots!" the crow man shouted. "Didn't you hear? He knows me. He knows my name. This is—"
"It's not like you to hold back on the edge of a battle, Bartimaeus," Mr. Hopkins called cheerily, dropping down toward the advancing djinn. "You're normally much farther away, cowering in a disused catacomb or something."
"That catacomb incident has been grossly misrepresented," I roared. "As I've explained countless times, I was guarding it against Rome's enemies, who might well have chosen—"
I stopped right there. That was the proof. No human knew where I'd loitered during the barbarian invasion, and precious few spirits either. The Folliots, Frisp, and Pollux had been present when I was discovered. They'd amused themselves afterward, recounting the tale to imps of their acquaintance. Sadly, both Folliots and imps were all soon killed in a variety of ways during the course of a single night, a bizarre coincidence, which quite wore me out. In fact, I could only think of one djinnie that still brought it up with metronomic regularity whenever our paths crossed over the centuries. And sure enough, that one was—
"Stop!" I cried, hopping from side to side in agitation. "It's not Hopkins at all. I don't know how, but it's Fakwal, and he—"
It was too late, of course. My companions were making far too many roars and rumbles for them to hear. Mind, I doubt they'd have stopped, even if they had heard. Certainly Ascobol and Hodge, who had no respect for their elders or betters, would have carried on regardless. Maybe Mwamba might have hesitated. But they didn't hear, and they all piled in. Well, it was four against one. Fakwal, armed only with a kitchen knife, versus four of the most ferocious djinn then at large in London. It was a hideous mismatch. I'd have helped my companions out, if I'd thought it would make any difference. Instead, I stole carefully toward the door. Thing was, I knew Fakwal. He had a certain breezy confidence that came from being very good at what he did. He wasn't like old Jabor had been, i.e. moronically strong to the point of indestructible. He wasn't like Grim Chu, who rarely needed to lift a finger to his enemies, so frightful and inventive were his words. No, Fakwal was an all-rounder. He had a practical take on survival that respected power and cunning equally. As of this moment, this was my view also. It was by cunningly respecting Fakwal's power that I intended to avoid being killed. Very good, and very quick. Crowhead had just negotiated a rack of omelette pans and was slipping past the pastry cases when a shower of plates fell around his ears. Armour plates, that is, lately of the pangolin. They were followed a second or so later by one or two other things, some of which, I'm sorry to say, were recognisable. It was only when I reached the kitchen door that I risked a quick look back. At the far end of the room was a whirl of movement, flashes of light, sounds and screams. Occasionally hands reached out from the vortex, grasped tables or small fridges, and plunged with them back out of sight. Fragments of metal, wood, and essence hurtled outward periodically. Time to depart. Some djinn of my acquaintance let loose a billowing fog to cover their tracks. Others prefer to leave a noxious inky vapour or a few illusions in their wake. Me, I hit the lights. Kitchen and dining room were plunged into darkness. Weird glints of a dozen colours emitted by the fighting djinn slid and spun across the walls. Ahead, a solitary wedge of light marked the way out to the corridor. I wrapped my cape of feathers close about me and was swallowed by the shadows. My crow-headed guise was the totem of the tribe that lived between plain and forest. They valued the bird's stealth and secrecy, his intelligence and guile. The cape included feathers of every bird living in those parts. With their power absorbed into mine, I could walk unnoticed over grass and stone and also converse respectfully with the tribe's shaman, who wore a similar costume complete with mask. I hadn't got halfway across the dining room when all sounds of combat behind me ceased. I halted, hoping against hope to hear my colleagues' cries of triumph. No luck. The silence beat against my feathered head. I concentrated and really strained for a scrap of sound. Perhaps I strained too hard. I thought to imagine a soft noise, as of someone floating through the dark. I hastened on. No point trying to run. Stealth was the key. I was in no state to contest with Fakwal, however eccentric his guise. I kept to the margins of the dining room, keeping well clear of the tables, chairs, and discarded cutlery. My cloak of shadows covered my bowed head. A yellow eye peeped out anxiously below a fringe of feathers. It checked behind. Through the arch leading to the kitchen came a patch of moving blackness. Light glinted on something in its hand. I picked up the pace a little, and in so doing kicked against a teaspoon which clinked against the wall.
"Dear me, Bartimaeus," a familiar voice called. "You really are addled tonight. A human might be foiled by the dark, but I can see you as clear as noonday, skulking over there beneath those rags. Stop a while and talk with me. I've missed our little chats."
Crowhead made no response, but hurried for the door.
"Aren't you just a little curious?"
The voice was nearer now.
"I'd have thought you'd be dying to know about my choice of form."
Sure, I was curious, but dying to know was exactly what I wasn't. I'm happy to indulge in snappy banter with the best of them, but chats are out when the alternative is escaping with my life. Mid-stride, the crow-headed man leapt forward, hands outstretched, as if diving into a swimming pool. His feathered cape swirled round him, flapped, became dark wings. The man was gone. A desperate crow darted forth, a feathered bolt making for the door. A sigh. A thud. A cawk of pain. The crow's progress was halted in a manner that brooked no argument. Pierced through a wingtip and suspended beneath a shimmering flash that shuddered, vibrated, stilled, and became a meat cleaver embedded in the wall. With nonchalant leisure, the thing with the body of Mr. Hopkins drifted across the empty room. The crow awaited it, swinging gently, an indignant expression on its beak. Mr. Hopkins drew close. One shoulder of his suit was a little scorched, and he had a slight cut upon one cheek. Other than that, he appeared uninjured. He hovered in the darkness a meter or so away, regarding me with a little smile. I guessed he was checking out my condition on the various planes. My weakness made me feel embarrassed, almost naked. I tapped the feathers of my free wing against the wall. "So go on, then," I snapped. "Get it over with." A frown passed across the inexpressive face.
"You want me to kill you already?"
"Not that. The rubbish joke you're thinking up. About it being good of me to hang around or something like that. Go on. You know you want to. Get it out of your system." The scholar looked pained.
"As if I'd stoop so low, Bartimaeus. You judge me by your own subterranean standards of repartee, which are as regrettable as the condition of your essence. Look at you, as perforated as a sponge. If I were your master, I'd use you to mop the floor."
I gave a groan. "That's probably on the agenda. I've done everything else."
"I'm sure you have. Well, it is a sorry state of affairs to see any spirit brought so low, even one as frivolous and irritating as you. It almost moves me to pity."
He scratched his nose.
"Almost, but not quite."
I searched the pale grey eyes. "It is you, isn't it?" I said.
"Certainly it is."
"But your essence? Where?"
"Right here. Hidden away inside the body of our dear Mr. Hopkins. As you must have deduced, this is no mere guise."
Fakwal's voice gave a little chuckle.
"What was that pathetic birdie get-up you were wearing just now? Native American totem? So messy and antiquated. Well, I've gone beyond that sort of thing."
"You're in his actual body?" I said.
"Yuck! That's icky.
Who's done this to you, Fakwal? Who's your master? I didn't understand this at all."
"My master?" The hovering man shook with mirth. "Why, Mr. Hopkins, of course.
And very grateful I am to him. So grateful that I think he and I will be working together for some little time to come.
He burst into another rich and hearty laugh. Coming from a fairly senior jinni like Fakwal, this laughter was curiously unnerving. We higher spirits have our humour, of course, which we employ as a corrective to our endless years of servitude on Earth. Normally it falls into a certain category, dry, sardonic, and observational, perpetually amazed by the foibles of the magicians. We don't tend to fall about in hysterics, that's just not done. I'm not talking about imps, of course, who seldom rise above recreational slapstick. This being so, there was something oddly unrestrained about Fakwal's mirth here, something a little too involved.
"Much has happened since last we met, Bartimaeus," he went on. "Do you remember how we parted?"
"No, I did."
"You set light to me, old friend. Struck a match and left me burning in a copse."
The crow shifted uneasily beneath the cleaver. "That's a gesture of endearment in some cultures. Some hug, some kiss. Some set each other on fire in small patches of woodland."
"Hmm. Well, you've been a slave to more humans than me, Bartimaeus. You'd know their ways if anyone would. Even so, it was a little painful."
He drifted closer.
"You weren't too badly off," I protested. "I caught sight of you again a couple of days later, playing cook again in the Headlam kitchen. Didn't seem too singed. What is it with you and kitchens, anyway? You're always hanging about in them."
This was true. Ever since the royal kitchens at Nineveh, circa 700 BC, I'd been sent there by Babylonian magicians on a diplomatic mission, e.g. to slip arsenic into Sennacherib's food during a banquet. Unfortunately, Fakwal was employed by the Assyrian king to seek assassins. He took exception to my tasty calves fat trifle and chased me about the hall. After the mother of all food fights, I felled him with a well-aimed hambone and made good my escape. Our relationship had generally deteriorated from here.
Hopkins, or Fakwal, gave a nod. "Lots of nice sharp weapons in kitchens."
He flicked the cleaver with a fingertip. Blade and the crow quivered and pulsed.
"Which is why I came down here just now. Also, it's more roomy than the corridor upstairs. I needed space to swing my arms a little. Space is at a premium in this hotel. Mind you, my room does have a jacuzzi."
My head spun.
"Wait a second," I said. "I know you as Fakwal of Sparta, Scourge of the Aegean. I've seen you as a slate-black giant crushing hoplite armies beneath your heels. Now what are you? A pigeon-chested human who likes his bath? What's going on? How long have you been trapped like this?"
"Just a couple of months. But I'm hardly trapped. The ambassador is a very plush and exclusive establishment. Hopkins liked the good things in life, you see. Also, it's out of reach of government spies, so I can come and go as I please. I saw no reason to change the arrangements."
The crow rolled its eyes.
"Not the hotel. I was talking about the body."
A chuckle.
"Your answer's the same, Bartimaeus. It's only a few weeks since the good Mr. Hopkins, how shall I put it, invited me in. It took a while to acclimatize, but I am now extremely comfortable. And despite appearances, my power is in no way reduced, as your friends have just found out."
He grinned. "Haven't fed so heavily for a long time."
"Yes, well."
I coughed uncomfortably. "I hope you weren't thinking of doing the same with me.
We go back a long way, you and I. A wonderful association, lots of shared experiences."
Mr. Hopkins' eyes gleamed with merriment.
"That's better, Bartimaeus. Your sense of humour is perking up. But in truth, I do not intend to devour you."
The crow had been hanging from the cleaver in rather a woe-begone manner. Now, with this unexpected news, it rallied.
"You don't? Fakwal, you are a generous friend. I apologize for that incident in the copse, and for our fights over the amulet, and for that convulsion from behind I got you with back in Heidelberg in 32.
I hesitated, which I see you didn't know was me. And all the rest. So, many thanks, and if you could just remove this cleaver, I'll be on my way. The bland-faced man did not remove the cleaver. Instead, he bent close to the crow. I didn't say I was sparing you, Bartimaeus. Just that I'm not going to eat you. The idea of it. Simply looking at your essence gives me indigestion. But nor am I going to let you go. This very night, you shall die horribly. Oh, great! In as painful and long drawn out a fashion as I can contrive. Look, you needn't put yourself out over this, but first I want to tell you something. Hopkins' grinning face came close. I want to tell you that you were wrong. I pride myself on my swift wit and keen intelligence, but this one had me stumped. Eh? Countless times, Farquhar continued, I have held out to you the hope that Jin would one day be free. Jin like you and me. Why do we fight? Because we are set against each other by our cursed human masters. Why do we obey them? Because we have no choice. Countless times I have speculated that these rules might be challenged. Countless times you have told me I was mistaken. I didn't put it quite like that. I said you were a complete... You said that we had no chance of ever breaking free of the twin problems, Bartimaeus. The problems of free will and pain. And I see that certainty in your squinty little eyes again. But you are mistaken. Look at me now. What do you see? I considered. A murderous maniac in human form? A hideous amalgam of the worst of man and jinn? I'm going out on a limb here. A former foe looking at me with unexpected pity and good fellowship? No, Bartimaeus. No. I'll tell you. You see a jinnee without pain. You see a jinnee with free will. I'm not surprised you don't understand. In 5,000 years there has never been a marvel like it. He held out a very human hand and gently ruffled my head feathers. Can you imagine it, you poor, wounded creature? No pain. No pain, Bartimaeus. Ah, he sighed, you can't think how clear-headed that makes me. No pain. In the back of my tired, befuddled mind, I saw a sudden image. Gladstone's skeleton, leaping, prancing. I met an Afreet once, I said. He said something like that, too. But his essence was trapped in human bones, and he went mad. In the end, he embraced extinction, rather than live on. Farquhar shaped Hopkins' face into an approximation of a smile. Ah, you speak of Honorius. Yes, I have heard of him. The poor fellow has been most influential. My essence is protected, just as his was, and like him, I have free will. But mark this, Bartimaeus. I shall not go mad. But to be in this world you must have been summoned, I persisted. So you must be doing someone's bidding. Hopkins summoned me, and I have done his bidding. Now I am free. For the first time I thought I saw something of the jinnee hidden within the man. Deep inside the eyes a little flash of triumph, almost like a flame. You may recall, Bartimaeus, that in our last conversation I spoke with optimism about the recklessness of certain London magicians, men who might one day give us our chance. I remember, I said, you were talking about Lovelace. True, but not only he. Well, it so happens that I was right. Our chance has come. First Lovelace overreached himself. His coup failed. He died, and I was... Freed, I cried. Yes, thanks to me, that was. You owe me one there, surely. Submerged in an offshore safe, thanks to a stringent after-death clause in my summoning, I spent my time cursing whoever killed Lovelace. Ah, that would be my master. I told him it was a hasty act, but did he listen? Luckily, I was released soon afterward by one of Lovelace's friends who knew of me and my talents. I have since been working with him. This would be Hopkins, I said. Well, as a matter of fact, no. Which reminds me, Farquhar looked at his watch, I cannot stand gossiping with you all evening. Tonight the revolution begins, and I must be there to witness it. You and your idiot friends have delayed me far too long. The crow looked hopeful. Does this mean you won't have time for that painful, long-drawn-out death you promised me? I won't, Bartimaeus. But you'll have all the time in the world. His hands reached out, grasped me around the neck, and plucked the cleaver from my wing. Hopkins' form rose into the air and turned to face the darkened dining-room. Let's see, Farquhar murmured. Yes, that looks promising. We drifted out above the tables, toward the opposite wall. A trolley stood there, just as the waiters had left it. On the center of the trolley was a large tureen with a domed lid. It was made of silver. The crow wriggled and fidgeted desperately in its captor's grip. Come on, Farquhar, I implored. Don't do anything you might regret. I most certainly won't. He descended beside the trolley, held me above the tureen. The cold radiation of the fatal metal tickled against my ragged essence. A healthy jinni might linger for weeks in a silver tomb like this, Farquhar said. The state you're in, I don't think we'll survive longer than a couple of hours. Now then, I wonder what we've got in here. With a hasty flick of the fingers, he flipped open the lid. Fish soup. Delightful. Well, goodbye, Bartimaeus. While you die, take consolation from the knowledge that the enslavement of the djinn is almost over. As of tonight, we take revenge. The fingers parted. With a delicate plop, the crow fell into the soup. Farquhar waved goodbye and closed the lid. I floated in darkness, silver all around me. My essence shrank and blistered. I had one chance. One chance only. Wait a little for Farquhar to depart, then summon up my last gasps of energy and try to burst open the lid. It would be tough, but feasible, provided he didn't wedge it shut with a block or anything. Farquhar didn't bother with a block. He went for the whole wall. There was a great roar and crash, a fearsome impact. The tureen collapsed around me, smashed into a crumpled mess by the weight of masonry above. Silver pressed on all sides. The crow writhed, wriggled, but had no space to move. My head swam. My essence began to boil. Almost gratefully, I fell into unconsciousness. Burned and squashed to death in a silver vat of soup. There may be worse ways to go, but not many. Chapter 21. Nathaniel. Nathaniel looked out of the window of the limousine at the night, the lights, the houses, and the people. They went by in a kind of blur, a mass of colour and movement that changed endlessly, beguilingly, and yet meant nothing. For a while he let his tired gaze drift among the shifting forms. Then, as the car slowed to approach a junction, he focused on the glass itself and on a reflection in it. He saw himself again. It was not a wholly reassuring sight. His face was etched with weariness, his hair damp, his collar limply sagging. But in his eyes a spark still burned. Earlier that day it had not been so. Successive crises. His humiliation at Richmond, the threats to his career, and the discovery of his earlier betrayal by Bartimaeus had hit him hard. His carefully constructed persona of John Mandrake, information minister, and blithely assured member of the council, had begun to crack around him. But it had been his rejection by Miss Lutyens that morning that had dealt the decisive blow. In a few moments of sustained contempt she had shattered the armour of his status and laid bare the boy beneath. The shock had been almost too much for Nathaniel. With the loss of self-esteem came chaos. He had spent the rest of the day locked in his rooms, alternately raging and subsiding into silence. But two things had combined to draw him back, to prevent him drowning in self-pity. First, on a practical level, Bartimaeus's delayed report had given him a lifeline. News of Hopkins's whereabouts offered Nathaniel a final chance to act before the next day's trial. By capturing the traitor, he might yet outmaneuver Farrah, Mortensen, and the rest of his enemies. Devereux would forget his displeasure and restore Nathaniel to a position of prestige. Such success was not guaranteed, but he was confident in the power of the djinn that he had sent to the hotel, and already he felt revived by the mere act of sending them. A warm feeling ran across his back, making him shudder a little in the confines of the car. At last he was being decisive once again, playing for the highest stakes, shrugging off the inertia of the last few years. He felt almost as he had done as a child, thrilling in the audacity of his actions. That was how it had often been, before politics and the stultifying role of John Mandrake had closed in on him. And he no longer wished to play that part. True, if fate were kind, he would first ensure his political survival. But he had long been tired of the other ministers, and sickened by their moral corruption, by their self-preserving greed. It had taken until today, with the disdain in the eyes of Ms. Lutyens and of Kitty Jones, to recognize that sickness in himself. Well, he would not sink back into the routines of the council. Decisive action was needed to save the country from their mismanagement. He peered through the window at the smudged outlines of people on the streets. The commoners needed to be led. They needed a new leader. Someone who could impose a little peace and security. He thought of the staff of Gladstone lying redundant in the vaults of Whitehall. Not that he should use force, of course. At least, not on the commoners. Kitty Jones had been right about that. He glanced across to where, agreeably close to him, the girl sat, gazing with remarkable serenity out into the night. She had been the second reason that his energies had revived, his spark rekindled, and he was very glad that he had found her. Her hair was shorter than he remembered, but her tongue was as sharp as ever. In their argument outside the inn, she had cut through his pretensions like a knife, shaming him repeatedly with her passionate assurance. Yet, and this was the strange part, he found he eagerly wanted to continue their talk. Not least, his brow darkened, because of that suggestion that she knew more about Bartimaeus's earlier career than he would have thought possible. It was very odd. But that could be explored at leisure, after the play, and after, with luck, his djinn had returned triumphant. Bartimaeus might throw some light on it himself. What he would do with her then, he honestly didn't know. The chauffeur's voice roused Nathaniel from his reverie.
"Almost at the theatre, sir."
"Good. How long's it taken?"
12 minutes, sir. I had to come the long way around. The centre of town's still barricaded off. There are demonstrations in the parks, a lot of police activity."
"Well, with luck, we'll miss the beginning of the performance."
Kitty Jones spoke for the first time on the journey. As before, he was impressed by her poise.
"So what is this play I must endure?"
Nathaniel sighed. "A makepiece premiere."
"Not the one who did Swans of Araby?"
"I'm afraid so. The Prime Minister's a fan. Therefore, every magician in the government, from council down to third secretary, must attend the show, on pain of his absolute displeasure. It is of the first importance." She scowled.
"What, with a war going on, and people rioting in the street?"
"Even so. I have vital work of my own tonight, but I must put it aside until the curtain falls. I just hope it's got a lot of intervals." He felt the shape of his scrying glass inside his coat. Between acts he would check on the progress of his djinn. They entered Shaftesbury Avenue, a cluttered curve of restaurants, bars, and theatres, many recently rebuilt in finest concrete under the government's slum clearance measures. Glowing neon lights, a new invention from Japan, spelled out the names of each establishment in pinks, yellows, mauve, vermilion. Throngs of lesser magicians and high-caste commoners milled upon the streets, accompanied by watchful night police. Nathaniel looked for evidence of social disorder, but the crowd seemed calm. The limousine slowed, pulled into a roped-off area beneath a golden awning. Police and black-coated security magicians stood behind the barricades. A few photographers knelt below them, cameras set on tripods. The front of the theatre was a blaze of light. A smart red carpet ran between the street and its open doors. A short, round gentleman stood upon the carpet, hands frantically waving.
As the car drew to a halt, Quentin Makepeace bobbed forward and thrust open the nearest side door.
"Mandrake, at last you're here. We haven't a moment to lose."
"I'm sorry, Quentin. Trouble on the streets."
Since witnessing the playwright's unsavory experiment with the commoner, Nathaniel regarded him with extreme dislike. The man was a pestilence and needed to be removed. All in good time.
"I know, I know. Come on, out with you. In 3 minutes I must be on stage. The hall doors are shut, but I have space for you in my personal box. Yes, yes, your girlfriend, too. She is far prettier than you or I. We can bask in her radiance. Come on, chop chop. 2 minutes and counting."
With a series of prods, tugs, and encouraging gestures, Mr. Makepeace ushered Nathaniel and Kitty out of the car, along the carpet and through the theatre doors. The harsh light of the foyer made them blink. They fended off bowing attendants, proffered cushions, trays of sparkling wine. The walls were covered with posters advertising the play. Most featured Quentin Makepeace, grinning, winking, or looking profound from a variety of angles. The man himself stopped at a narrow staircase.
"Up there. My private box. I will join you presently. Wish me luck!"
Then he was gone, a diminutive whirlwind of oiled hair, gleaming teeth, bright and sparkling eyes. Nathaniel and Kitty ascended the stairs. At the top was a drawn curtain. They pushed it aside and ducked through into a small enclosure hung with satin drapes. Three ornamental chairs faced a low balustrade. Beyond and below lay the stage, half concealed behind thick curtains, the orchestra pit and a sea of stalls filled with minutely moving heads. The lights had been turned low. The crowd murmured like the wind in a forest. In the depth, the orchestra emitted discordant sounds. They sat, Kitty in the farthest chair, Nathaniel beside her. He leaned over, whispered in her ear.
"This is quite an honour for you, Miss Jones. You are without doubt the only commoner present. See in that box opposite? That fellow leaning forward with the uncouth eagerness of a schoolboy? That is our Prime Minister. Beside him sits Mr. Mortensen, the beloved War Minister.
The one with the paunch is Collins of the Home Office.
In the box below, with a scowl upon his face, sits Sholto Pinn, the famous retailer. To the left, yawning like a cat, is Whitwell of Security. Miss Farrah of the Police is in the box beyond."
He broke off. As if sensing his scrutiny, Jane Farrah had glanced at him across the great, dark gulf. Nathaniel gave her an ironic salute, a little wave. His feeling of reckless excitement had grown with the passing minutes. If all went well, Ascobol and the others would soon have Hopkins under guard. He would see how dear Miss Farrah handled that tomorrow. With a certain ostentation, he bent his head close to Kitty Jones's again.
"What a pity your resistance is no longer active," he whispered. "A well-directed bomb here would decapitate the government."
It was true. The stalls below were filled with all the secondary ministers, their wives, their assistants, deputies, and special advisers. He saw the obsessive craning of heads as each person compared their position with those of their rivals. He saw the flash of binoculars, heard the rustling of sweetmeat wrappers, sensed the excitement radiating from the crowd. On the second and third planes, a number of small imps were visible, hopping and jigging upon the shoulders of their masters, busily inflating their chests and biceps to improbable sizes and exchanging insults with their neighbours. The noises from the orchestra dwindled. A violin shrieked once. All was still. Lights faded in the auditorium. A spotlight illuminated the curtains at the centre of the stage. Silence. A drum roll, an ecstatic fanfare from the trumpet section. The curtain twitched and was flung aside. Out strode Makepeace, resplendent in a frock coat of crushed green velvet. He spread his arms like a mother to her babes and welcomed the audience's applause. Two bows to the balconies, one to the stalls. He raised his hands.
"Ladies and gentlemen, you are too kind, too kind. Please!"
The cheering died away.
"Thank you. Before the show begins, a special announcement. It is a privilege, nay, an honour, to present my latest little trifle to such a distinguished audience. I see we have a full complement of the great, led by our wonderful arbiter of good taste, Mr. Rupert Devereux."
A judicious pause for enthusiastic cheering.
Quite so. And it is because of the affection that we all feel for dear Rupert that I have penned From Wapping to Westminster, a small diversion based on his inspiring life. As you will see from the program notes, only the scene in the nun's dormitory is fictitious. The rest of the marvels, sensations, wonderments, and prodigies are firmly based on fact. I hope you are educated and entertained.
A brief bow, a broad smile.
As usual with my productions, may I request that no flash photography takes place? It can put off the performers. In addition, several of the special effects used on stage tonight are magical in origin, created by a crew of willing demons. These illusions will be most satisfactory if you watch without your lenses in. There is nothing more likely to ruin the enjoyment of a wedding scene than seeing a couple of round-bottomed imps emitting the fireworks in the background.
Laughter.
Thank you. Can I also request that all personal demons are dismissed for the duration of the show, lest they prove distracting? Enjoy the evening. May it be one you never forget.
A step backward, a swish of the curtain. The spotlight went out. All across the auditorium came a faint rustling and popping. The sounds of lens cases being removed from bags and jacket pockets, opened, filled, shut fast again. The magicians uttered terse commands. Their imps shimmered, dwindled, and vanished. As he removed his lenses, Nathaniel glanced at Kitty Jones, who sat impassively watching the stage. She didn't seem likely to try anything foolish. Nevertheless, he knew he was taking a risk. Frittang had been dismissed, and all his other active demons were off pursuing Hopkins. He had no servants readily at hand. What if she reverted to her former type? A roll of drums, a rush of violins in the darkness below, horns blared in the distance, a militaristic fanfare which swiftly became a jaunty music hall theme. The curtains swept aside, revealing a beautifully painted depiction of a London street scene 40 years before. Tall townhouses, market stalls, a flat blue sky behind, Nelson's Column in the background, fluffy pigeons on strings flying to and fro. A procession of barrow boys wheeled carts on stage from either side. As they met in the middle, they exchanged loud Cockney pleasantries and began slapping their thighs to the music hall beat. With a sinking heart, Nathaniel knew that the first song was already upon them. He sat back in his chair, thinking despairingly of the scrying glass in his pocket. Perhaps he could just slip off and check what was going on.
"Not a bad beginning, eh, John?"
As if he had sprung up from a hidden trapdoor, Mr. Makepeace was at his side, settling into his seat, wiping perspiration from his forehead.
"A nice little number. Sets the scene admirably."
He chuckled.
"Already Mr. Devereux is transfixed. See how he laughs and claps his hands together."
Nathaniel peered into the darkness.
"You have better eyesight than I. I cannot make him out." "That is because you have taken out your lenses like a good, obedient boy. Put them back in again and see."
"But
put them back in again, my boy. Here in my box different rules apply. You're exempt from the general direction."
"But what about the illusions?"
"Oh, you'll see enough to keep you entertained. Trust me."
A hearty chuckle. The man was a capricious fool. With a mixture of annoyance and bemusement, Nathaniel returned his lenses to his eyes. By viewing the second and third planes, he was instantly able to reduce the darkness in the auditorium and make out the magicians on the far side. As Makepeace had said, Devereux was craning forward, eyes riveted on the stage. His head nodded to the music. The other ministers, in various attitudes of dejection and dismay, had given themselves up to the inevitable. On stage, the Cockney barrow boys skipped off, leaving the way clear for the appearance of the young Prime Minister-to-be. The pale, thin youth that Nathaniel had met at Richmond now dawdled from the wings. He wore a school blazer, shirt and tie, and a pair of short trousers from which his hairy legs plunged a disconcerting distance. His cheeks had been heavily rouged to give him the appearance of childish vigour, but his movements were oddly listless. He flopped to a standstill beside a cardboard postbox and began a quavering oration. In the darkness at Nathaniel's side, Makepeace gave a cluck of dissatisfaction.
"Bobby has proved such a trial," he breathed. "During rehearsals, he developed a most dreary cough.